Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast, episode 245. As we record this, it is 345.
It is, as I just pointed out.
I know.
That's quite the Bill and Ted moment, that one.
I was trying to think if there were any notable comics for issue 245.
When you start getting past the 200s, usually the books start to suck. Am I wrong on this?
Like, what was in Kenny X-Men 245? I mean, that's got to be, like, something.
It was probably, like, one of those Silvestri ones. It could be something notable, but...
Yeah.
Here's the deal. Dave and I are both old men, and therefore anything X-Men past about 220 is sucky.
That's
wow.
True.
Okay.
Dave, back me up.
Rewind it to around issue 200, but
yeah,
yes.
I know you would, but that's when I started, so.
Yeah, sorry, you came in on the crap,
which
Randy.
Is weird, because I'm young, or you're younger than me, but somehow you started X-Men before me. Because
I was cool.
Oh my
I was
God.
There before it was
so
cool.
So my phone is like moving like an inch.
I found it, Nick.
What is it?
X-Men 245 was a fill-in issue, featuring writer Chris Claremont and artist Rob Liefeld in a one-issue Invasion parody.
Oh, yeah. I was literally just telling Nick about this issue, though, a few weeks ago. It is an amusing idea. Do you know the issue, Randy?
Yeah, I know the issue.
It
I
has,
read it.
The art is terrible, but they're fake alien dominators, their spoof of DC's guys. They're about to invade, and they pull up the data on Earth or whatever, and they're like, oh my god, it's like, it's host to the Phoenix Entity. It has repelled multiple attacks from Galactus.
Yeah.
It is the chosen homeworld of Galactus's herald, Silver Surfer. And they, like, reel out all the incontinuity cosmic stuff the millions of time Earth's been protected or whatever.
And everyone's like,
and they're just
we...
like, retreat.
They don't even, why do
they're
we
like,
go
cancel
here?
The invasion.
Why do we go here?
Yeah. As a goof, it's actually pretty funny. Claremont was kind of funny.
It's okay.
So yeah, as an overall best. Issue, it's...
So, Amazing Spider-Man 245, however, was the reveal of Hobgoblin, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, that's
which
that's
was a solid,
good.
Which is
that's
a solid issue.
Yeah, no, that's more than solid. That's like, that's an amazing issue. I forgot that that's where Spider-Man was, where those issues were happening.
It's a great cover, by the way.
Yeah, that's Romita Jr. doing what I think is some of his best work.
Avengers 245 was a Captain Marvel issue.
Okay.
Captain Marvel and Dire Wraiths. So, all right, you know what? I take back what I said about 245s.
Right.
They're okay.
A solid era for Jim Shooter's reign on Marvel.
Yeah. However...
Now, DC issue numbers of 245, I don't know.
Who knows?
When you start getting to 345s.
Did Hellblazer make it to 300 issues?
I believe it did.
So there's like a Hellblazer 245 in there.
Yeah.
With a British writer that is well past like Garth Ennis' era. Is it the cast-off Brits?
Probably. Cast-off Brits.
That probably was like my carry at that point, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just throw my carry under
the double-decker bus.
I was trying to think.
Yeah. I knew where you were headed.
Do you have to throw it more than once?
Because this is a double-decker?
It's a double-decker.
Once is all it takes, so with a double-decker.
No, oh Brits are immune to being run over by buses.
You have to do it twice.
Is that a thing?
Yes.
That's a class feature?
People don't know that about British, but yeah. If you take Brits, you get a +2 to Constitution. And
vulnerability to bus.
You get advantage
things.
On saves against getting run over by buses.
Immunity
very
from
specific.
Bus.
Okay. So store news. We are in the midst of our inventory sale. This week it is 37 to 47% off with stuff on the table. There's a bunch of good stuff in there still. Mm-hmm. Including, I believe, we still have a fair amount of the Batman Animated Series figures.
Yes, we
which
do.
At 50% off are a steal.
Yes. I think the one Robin one we had, I saw somebody pick up on one of the first few days, but there's actually like a lot of good characters
floating
around.
But yeah, there's like the
Etrigan,
like, two-pack.
The Etrigan and Clarion two-pack, yeah.
And like the Roxy Rocket, and there's a bunch of, like, Harvey Bullock.
There's also a lot of Scarecrows and a lot of Jervis Tetches.
Right.
So if you need to get your Tetch on.
Yeah.
Tetch on. By the way, I have all those figures. I do have weird, crooked teeth Jervis Tetch, because I bought that entire line.
I Tetch myself.
You know, I honestly
what if
think...
he said that? He should say that in a comic. Scott Snyder?
No.
You gonna go Dr. Light with him?
He should never say those words.
You know, he's only abusing himself when he Tetches himself.
However, I will say that is probably my favorite version of the Mad Hatter.
The version that Tetches himself?
Sure.
Animated series version?
The animated series version.
I would agree with that.
Right. He's a character who does not have a lot of great stories in him, but those were more memorable.
Yeah. Oh, worth noting, by the way, while we're talking store news, we got Scythe back in. Not just like the main game, which finally came back in, but all the expansions. If you've never played Scythe, Dave and I both played it.
Yep.
It is a Sort of territory control game where you play a faction within an alternate world Russia that has like farming mechs.
Right, right. It's like the 1930s where tech moved to mech type robots.
Yeah,
has some of the most amazing art. And I'm just flat out say the best art I've ever seen in a board game.
It's really good.
They put out art books and stuff in this, and I was like, I would buy it just for the setting. I feel like there should be at least one movie in this.
It's
setting.
Also a really good game.
Yeah,
like I really like the game. I like the gameplay and
it's one of those deep games with it, which has several different avenues. Like not several, like a dozen different avenues to victory.
Yeah,
and you know the fight over resources is exciting and tough, but you kind of always feel like you have some options.
Yeah, and the expansions add things like airships and a couple mm-hmm. different factions.
New factions,
like,
yeah,
like a Japanese faction, a British faction, mm-hmm. and it's good stuff.
Randy, also on a store news sort of flashback, I just want to say we had a strong turnout for the Kate's Final Fantasy game that she ran, a card game last Sunday. And I think, I don't know if we put the next one on the schedule yet.
She hasn't given me the schedule yet, but I know
it's broadly once a month.
Yeah.
And I was just like, if anybody out there who has even like a remote interest in that game, should definitely come out those days.
Yeah, we've got some freebies, some extra starter decks, that kind of thing, so you can get basically a shot at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. This weekend, this Saturday, if you happen to be around going to the Central Texas Kids and Teens Comic Con, which is at Round Rock High School, from 1 o'clock to about 2 o'clock, I'll be doing a character building D&D 101 thing where I will basically be teaching kids and teens how to make their first D&D character that will be Adventurers League legal. I am working on that as we speak. I spent a fair amount of time on it last night. Yeah. If it goes well, I'll see if I can find a way to use it in store. But basically, it is a... Hey, you never made a character? We're going to make characters as the room together are going to make characters. At the end of the game, or at the end of the session, you'll have a first character.
Yep. That sounds super cool. Main character is one of the fun things in D&D. You're picking the hero that gets to be your avatar. And it's a little simple slice of that D&D experience.
Yep.
You can then take that character and with some buddies, go grab a monster manual or something like that and, create some little adventure scenarios on your own.
The ambitious part of my brain is already thinking of a D&D 101 program that I could sort of build out from and do a how to dungeon master.
Oh, you should definitely do that.
You know, I got plenty of free time. So. But, we have had requests for that kind of thing and we've had to lay it off onto volunteers and, at some point, I may have to bite the bullet and actually start some kind of D&D 101 program that I can do so that we can actually do that.
I think it would be cool.
also, off-site, got a bunch of off-site stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Easy Tiger game nights. Come out to Easy Tiger. It's one Tuesday a month. This time it's going to be Tuesday, February 19th from 6:30 to about 8:30. We usually run a little later than that, but come out, play some board games. I have a variety of them. I teach a few, and then we just kind of leave it open for people to come and play games. Especially if you know how to play games and you're looking for people to play with, there'll be a bunch of people there who really want to learn how to play games and don't know how, and I can't teach everybody and also, like, keep up with the game. So if you know how to teach games and you want to come out and find some people to play games with, this is a great time to do it.
Drop some knowledge.
Yeah, also, amazing food and drinks.
Yes.
We have our Magic the Gathering Ravnica Allegiance weekend coming up. That is Saturday, February 16th. We'll be doing a draft tournament. That's this weekend, isn't it?
That's this weekend.
That's
this
Saturday.
Yeah.
So we'll be doing that. I won't be here.
Yeah,
so you guys
be
enjoy
here.
That.
Sure.
And I think we'll be sort of running point on the draft.
Yeah.
There'll be some free cards, some bonus cards, and that kind of stuff for everybody to come out. And then, just as a heads up coming up, we'll keep mentioning this, but Monday, March 4th, we will be closed to our annual inventory, so don't plan to come to the store on Monday,
March
4th.
That is the one day that you set aside to do your comic and game shopping. You're going to have to reschedule.
You're
going to
be very sad when you put your nose up against the glass like a puppy stuffed out in the dark.
Right, and you see us inside the store, half out of our mind, with counting things and listening to music with swears in it.
Yep. All right, moving on to non-store news. There's apparently a new Muppet show with Josh Gad they're going to do on Disney Plus. This,
Who is Josh Gad?
It's called... Josh Gad? You don't know who Josh Gad
No.
is? He was in Book of Mormon. He was the voice of Olaf.
Okay.
He's one of these sort of,
Is he a comedian?
Punchy comedic actor.
Yeah.
Okay. Who can sing.
There you go.
He's a good fit for the Muppets. He actually kind of is a Muppet.
It wasn't the dude who played What's-His-Name in Beauty and the Beast, was
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was Gaston. Or the Gaston,
his toady.
Yeah, his toady. Yes,
yeah.
Yes, that is him.
LeFou.
This is called Muppets Live Another Day.
Is this going to tie into James Bond Die Another Day?
Takes place immediately following the Muppets take Manhattan as Kermit disbands the Muppet troupe and then needs to get them back together again to find the missing Rolf the dog.
Did you say the Muppets take Manhattan?
Yeah.
The movie from the 1980s?
Yeah.
Is it going to be set in the 1980s? Because that would be kind of fun.
That is weird. I don't know.
Everything is cyclical. It all comes back.
Yeah. I did not think of Muppets as having tight continuity in particular. But that's interesting, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't
know. It's still kind of rumory, but... It's there. Marvel's or Disney's streaming service is shaping up to have some pretty impressive stuff on it.
Yeah.
Depending
on what they... I'm curious to see what they launch with. Like, what their opening kind of... I would imagine, like, Mandalorian will be their first show.
I think it will, and I'm sure that one of the Marvel shows will be on there first thing, too.
Probably so.
Speaking of Marvel shows, Jeff Loeb has been reportedly cut out of the Disney Plus thing. He's not running the Disney Plus
TV stuff. That's what I hear.
But apparently he's still got his thumb in somewhere because there are four linked... shows coming not to Netflix but to Hulu. They're going to be animated, and they're going to be comedies. MODOK, Hitmonkey, Tigra and Dazzler, sorry.
Yeah.
And Howard the Duck. And then they'll cross over to a special called The Offenders, which is a joke about the Defenders. Loeb really does not want to let go of the Netflix stuff. And it's like, so Howard the Duck is going to be done by Kevin Smith and the guy from Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
That's not a bad...
You know, that actually... That sounds like what they're going for is, it, like, Marvel's loser heroes by way of Adult Swim.
Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that there's a big audience for this. I think they should probably go ahead and do a Next Wave cartoon to go with it. Because it seems like this is exactly what it's going to be, is taking perfect good properties and ruining them forever for me.
That's how I feel every time I read any sort of slight meta joke or bit of goofiness in any Marvel comic ever.
Well, here's the other thing. The MODOK one is going to be basically, MODOK struggles to maintain control of his evil organization and his demanding family. It sounds, I would love to see MODOK show up in the Iron Man live action movies as a serious threat, but I understand he's a big baby head and he's never going to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
And
By the way, you could totally do weird David Cronenberg body horror, cool Kirby armor and stuff like that, and sell it. I'm actually disappointed in the imagination of people that they can only go the joke route, that it's lame writers.
Me too, and especially disappointed, but also potentially interested because the people doing it, Jordan Bloom, who I assume is related to Blumhouse somehow.
Okay.
And Patton Oswalt.
Yeah?
Patton Oswalt has comic book cred. Like, he's a guy who knows his stuff.
He's also... He's a comedian. He's a great comedian.
Yeah, but it... But do you want comedians running Marvel?
No, I do not. Also, Hitmonkey, which I believe is a Frank Cho creation.
It was.
That is Josh Gordon and Will
Maybe
Speck,
he can become... maybe he can become a thing now and they can bring him into the live-action MCU.
Oh, God.
Along with Deadpool.
Why Tigra and Dazzler?
Tigra and Dazzler is a show about two woke superheroes and best friends. Join them as they fight for recognition among power people who make up the 8 million stories in Los Angeles.
That sounds like you're going to be spoofing wokeness, which
it does, but
is
here's the thing.
Kind of tone deaf.
The writers are Erica Rivenoa and Chelsea Handler, who are people I would think... I don't find Chelsea Handler particularly funny, but I do think that she's not someone who's going to be making fun of wokeness.
Right.
Although there may be a little bit... political correct kind of thing. Like,
right.
Political correctness has gone too far, and that'll get on my nerves real fast.
Yeah. You know, the sad thing is that, like, I get it. Tigra and Dazzler are C-list characters.
Yep.
But they're always still characters that I could see something being done with. So it's a little disappointing to me that they're about to become the, you know, kind of notable joke characters.
I agree. That's what disappoints me about all this. Like, all these characters are about to become nothing but a joke for a decade.
When, in fact, only Hitmonkey deserves that fate.
Yes, Hitmonkey definitely deserves that fate.
Well, I mean... We don't know if it's going to be, like, detrimental to the character IP. I mean...
Jeff Loeb.
Well, it could tank and be not detrimental to anything but Jeff Loeb's cred.
Right. So, I mean, in the same way that, you know, the Star Trek animated series or the multiple animated series that are coming out, they might all be good. These might be good.
I can weigh the percentages, though.
I think the odds of the animated series, the Star Trek animated series being good seems much more likely than any of these being good.
I think because Loeb does have a track record with TV and animation, that's fair point. although I'm pretty sure that the Trek animation is not going to be for me.
Yeah, no. Well, you don't like humor.
Correct.
I'm still puzzled why they didn't do the Deadpool animated series by
that
Donald
is
Glover.
Weird. Like, that would have made perfect sense in here.
Yeah, it would have worked. But I mean, this is basically Marvel stepping away from. Netflix and then going to Hulu because Disney owns a portion of Hulu. So I mean,
it seems to me like it's a bone thrown to Jeff Loeb.
I guess we know that the Fox deal is complete because they're using Dazzler. I mean, they're going to have to reference her as a mutant. She's,
I guess, with Dazzler. Dazzler's not particularly, she probably wasn't,
you don't have to mention that she's a mutant, probably. Yeah, yeah. You can probably just say she's got powers over light and sound.
I mean, it's going to be an animated cartoon that she could have been bitten by a radioactive disco ball.
Yeah. That's exactly what it had to be.
Wow. I think these will be better than a radioactive disco ball.
You know what's weird is, if they want to lure in the kind of the average person, those characters are like really all unknowns. Not even C-list. There is no name recognition for Dazzler. Howard the Duck is the best they've got.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what Hitmonkey is. And what was the other one?
MODOK.
MODOK. Nobody knows what MODOK is. I guess it's kind of a deep cut for Marvel fans.
Yeah. I think you're right though, Dave. It speaks to laziness. It's like there's going the comedic route with them is lazy.
Right. Well, we'll see if they can come through. They have the creative team, so
that said,
there's a shot.
MODOK, remember the Jeff Parker stuff that was done in the Marvel Avengers, the kids stuff that he did. MODOK is kind of a jokey character, but it was fun. But he was also a threat to the Avengers.
Yeah.
And I think that probably this is going to be wacky MODOK as the boss from Office Space.
It's possible. But, you know, if Patton Oswalt, how involved he is in actually the writing of it. Yeah. I mean, he's smart. We'll see. I can't write these off.
So Netflix lost all the Marvel stuff, so they're instead making superhero stuff from Mark Miller. Non-superhero stuff, too. But
right.
So one of those things is Jupiter's Legacy, which was the
multi-generational superhero.
Yeah, like the revered elder guard have gotten older, and their children are struggling to live up to their parents and maybe being a little snotty. And it's going to be by Stephen S. DeKnight, who did Daredevil.
Yep.
The cast includes Josh Duhamel from Transformers, Ben Daniels from The Crown, Leslie Bibb from a bunch of stuff, Elena Kamporis from Sacred Lies, Andrew Horton from How to Talk to Girls at Parties, lots of stuff I never see. Also, Matt Lanter from Timeless, who was like the...
Yeah.
And Mike Wade from For the People. I don't know who most of these names are. Like, I sort of recognize them. And I only read a few issues of this, but I'm interested.
Yeah, it's a good group of people.
I'm curious to see a
character actors, so I think they'll bring a certain quality to the show.
I'm vaguely curious about this one because it's I don't think the CW has shown sort of pretty vast superhero tapestries, but a sort of a planned generational thing is something I don't think we've ever really seen.
No.
In a weird way, Mark Miller will, through this show, get a leg up on anybody, all the guys who inspired it, you know, whether they're Marvel, DC. I've not read it, though. I don't know quite what to expect. A little touches of realism, touches of homages to Silver and Bronze Age stuff.
It's exciting. We're going to get an opening credit sequence that will incorporate Frank Quitely's artwork.
That's true.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. He's the one who drew it.
Actually, I mean, like, different people did draw...
They did a back and forth. It was Frank Quitely did one of them, and then I forget who drew the other one. It was somebody really good, though.
Did you read them, Nick?
I didn't.
Okay.
It's one of the few Mark Miller books that I probably would have enjoyed, but I think I was in my I hate Mark Miller at that point.
I might
in time.
Actually take a look at that one in advance of the show. I do better with Mark Miller when he's not at part of a mega franchise like Marvel or DC.
Yeah, so we'll agreed. See.
So apparently Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese are developing something called Devil in the White City for Hulu. I don't know what this is.
This is a true crime about I forget his name, H.H. Holmes?
H.H. Holmes, yep, there it is.
And his murder house. It's actually his real thing.
I saw this referred, Timeless did a story on this.
Yeah, and they've done countless, like, specials, and podcasts have definitely covered it. It's a creepy idea
to fetishize it once again.
Well, I mean, it's about a guy who literally had a home, and it was, like a hotel kind of thing, and with death traps, and he was insane. I mean, the links that he, like, killed his wives, and then found new wives, killed them. It's dark.
What's the setting? What year...
I forget.
Oh,
it's
I want to say it was like the 1800s,
1900s.
Yeah, I think it was 1900s. If I'm not mistaken.
That was 1900s. Yeah, it was.
I could be completely off base on that one, but I'm pretty sure.
But that's interesting. And DiCaprio would play the lead character, which is
I would assume
that's what they're saying.
Yeah,
and for Hulu, that's a notable thing. That's a big get. So
yeah, Well, I mean, it's also Scorsese, right? Yeah. I mean, that's a huge get.
Well, Scorsese, apparently The Irishman, his new, like, Goodfellas, you know, he's got some Goodfellas
cast. That's Netflix, right?
That's going on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
I think we're seeing the big swing of streaming services and TV getting big game.
Yeah, because they're starting to get a lot more movies that go straight to Netflix. Yeah,
and soon we're going to see that. I don't know if award shows are still kind of pushing back, but getting those nominated for things.
Yeah.
Like, I know some people are like, oh, it didn't premiere at such and such. It can't be involved.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We might see more and more of it, and if that continues, we're going to have to cave.
Yeah. All right. Last thing, there was a trailer for Hulu's adaptation of Joseph Heller's Catch-22. This is George Clooney writing, directing, and also starring. It's basically looks like it's 6 episodes. It's got a huge cast.
Yeah.
Saw Hugh Laurie in there, Kyle Chandler.
Satirical war story stuff.
War story stuff.
I feel like...
The trailer looks great.
Yeah, I feel like the vibe is like, a little bit of MASH is, I think...
MASH, it's almost most absurd in some
ways. Yeah, and kind of probably embittered.
I'm going to be the... I'm gonna
Clooney's presence actually reminded me a little bit of Three Kings as well, which was also a semi-satirical, action movie.
I'm going to throw some truth. I've never read Catch-22.
Me neither.
Wow.
We're a bunch of dum-dums.
Yeah, I only read comic books.
I started to read it one time, and I was not feeling it, but it was interesting. So the book immediately, you'll find, has the tone of a caustic, ultra-cynical narrator.
Yeah.
And it was actually slightly off-putting to me. That personality can sometimes grate on me real fast. It's like, if John Constantine... Let me put it this way. If Warren Ellis... it's that sort of Warren Ellis voice. And I like Warren Ellis at times, but when he's full Warren Ellis, I don't know if I could spend a whole book with it in his head.
Right.
So that said, I'd kind of like to revisit it as well. I know it is a seminal look at sort of the absurdity of war and bureaucracy and all these things.
You know what's interesting is it gave me a Coen Brothers vibe.
Yeah.
And Clooney definitely picked up some stuff. He's worked a lot with the Coens. His directing style, he definitely picked up on this sort of their satirical.
But it's kind of that larger-than-life style.
Yeah.
But he also has his own sort of voice as well, which is shown in, like, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and a few other things.
Yeah.
He definitely learned a lot from the Coen brothers, but it's not a complete rehash.
I'm pretty excited by this. It actually was... I was pretty impressed with the trailer. The cast looks fantastic. The notion of sort of this darkly satirical look at the Vietnam War, it's interesting. So
actually, is it Vietnam?
Is it?
I thought it was World War II.
I think it's World War II.
Yeah. It's not Vietnam.
Right, it is World War II.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
I like Kyle Chandler a lot, so I'm glad to see him getting a larger part.
Yep. All right. That's our news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics.
One familiar cry.
We're talking comics for the Wednesday, February 13th, and I'm going to start us off this week.
Yep. Did we determine that among all of our picks are some number is a number
we
one?
We all have a new number one this week.
It's exciting.
Series.
Multiple companies represented.
I like this ship. It's exciting.
What you got?
All right. I'm talking about Savage Sword of Conan number one, which is funny because I remember when they announced all this stuff, I was like, that's great, but I think I'm done with Conan.
Yeah.
Turns out I wasn't.
Ironically, I am done with Conan.
I know.
But... they're cool. It's cool stuff going on.
This is the same conversation we had when Marvel brought Star Wars back.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm done with Star Wars.
I was worried about it.
And how many hardcovers do you have on your shelf?
You know what? This is not about me.
Before Randy goes on about Conan, I have to say, we were excited when we realized, like, what if they got G.I. Joe back and put all their A-listers on it? But because we're excited, that means if they do that, it's going to suck.
No.
Because it has to throw us off.
Oh, fair enough.
No.
I think that they are doing similar to what they did with Star Wars, where basically they're putting A-list writers on it. And in fact, even the presentation of it has the big double-page Savage Sword of Conan and like a lot of
this is what they did with Dark Vader Star Wars.
So it's the same approach. We realized recently it was the same approach. It's like two main series, so Conan and Savage Sword, and then a rotating miniseries. So they're going to do Billy the Pirate Queen.
Yep.
So Savage Sword, I still have a little bit of consternation when I was going to read it because Jerry Duggan is hit and miss for me.
Yeah.
And,
but he's definitely become A-list for Marvel.
And yeah, for sure. And I was like, I like Conan. Do I really need two different Conans a month? Like, how much Conan can I take? Well, at least two issues because this is a different approach from the Conan book, which is doing a sort of a longer form story. this is going to be, I guess, a series of different arcs, maybe in different points of his history. And this one takes place starting with Conan at sea, where he gets picked up by some slavers, and he's, like, almost dead. And they're like, well, throw him in the hold. If somebody will buy him if he lives, just like the rest of them. Turns out probably that was not the best decision they could have made. They probably shouldn't have brought Conan aboard because...
I'm going to guess that, by the way, to them he was just kind of some burly sailor or something like that. Yep. They didn't know it was Conan.
They did not know it was Conan. So he gets chained to this guy who's sort of a coward. And he has to break free, and there's some supernatural stuff going on in it. So, you know, wizards are always bad in the Conan world.
Is this a seagoing galley adventure?
This is Conan escapes from slavery on the high seas.
Drawn expertly by Ron Garney.
Ron Garney does a fantastic art. There is, as with all the Conan books from Jason Aaron so far, Dugan has some fun moments. I'm not going to give away too many of them, but there is a great thing where he's about to break free. Oh, well, the second page... It has the caption, "The day did not start auspiciously for Conan." And this is on a full splash page where he is eating a dead shark on a floating board.
Yeah.
And it's like a great understatement. And then there's a moment where there's like a jailer that he's like trying to break free. And the jailer says something like, he says, "I don't have the key." And he says, "Wrong. You have a small bone I can use to pick the lock."
Like a finger bone,
yeah. He breaks his finger off and uses it, which is... very Conan. I greatly enjoyed this. It leads into sort of a story arc where maybe it's going to put him on a treasure hunt, and it's everything you want Conan to be, and definitely worth a read if you're enjoying the other one. Dave, what you got?
I have a lighthearted offering to prove that I love laughter.
You hate laughter and are always 100% serious.
What's the name of this guy? Mark Russell. Mark Russell, people know from the Flintstones comic, which was a humorous comic, which I enjoyed. What else did he do? The Snagglepuss thing.
Yeah. He did something recently.
He's kind of, you know who he is? He's like, this comparison's like his...
Red Sonja for last
Red
week.
Red Sonja, yeah. He has somewhat become what Steve Gerber was in the 70s. He kind of is now, the satirist.
Yeah.
You know? But he's got a broad scope, too. Steve Gerber was also not... Howard the Duck was what I was thinking of from Gerber. But he also wrote, Defenders and other books like this.
Yeah.
I honestly think Mark Russell is kind of like that... He's that weirdo writer,
he
too.
He's definitely that Steve... Gerber was also sort of politically active.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Russell is the modern-day Steve Gerber. Makes so much sense.
And so he's got his serious stuff, action adventure he's doing with Red Sonja. And then you have something lighter here. This is the Wonder Twins comic from DC... this is from their Wonder Comics line, which is kind of their teen heroes thing. So far, it's included Bendis's Young Justice and Naomi.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this is the first one that's not... Well, Naomi was co-written by Mark...
David Walker.
David Walker.
I'm making up names.
And Bendis's name is not on this. I thought he was, like, co-showrunning the whole thing.
Yeah, I guess he's maybe like sort of the supervising. Actually, they don't even have him as like a supervising
editor. He's not listening to credits at all. I wonder if maybe this was a outside pitch that Russell made and they just folded it into this.
Maybe so. But it still feels like a pretty easygoing fit.
Yeah.
So this is the Wonder Twins, those goofy characters that you might have like hated on Super Friends or tolerated.
Yep.
But have not. They're not much has been done with them ever since then. Every once in a while, somebody does a little minor revamp, usually as a backup story or something like that.
Yep.
This is them front and center in a drama that Nick likened earlier to Sky High, and I think there's definitely some of that vibe to it. I
see that.
So the kids are in high school. They are somewhat inexplicably just wearing their costumes throughout the day.
Sure.
And sort of trying to survive high school, weirdly being upfront about their... Because they've got like pointed ears, purple costumes.
Yep.
And Zan... is it just outright explains his like origin on an alien world, a sort of world where there's no poverty and no crime unless people are bored and the food is bland and it's a lot like Sweden, he says.
Yeah.
Except for one thing.
Except what's the one thing? Right. Sure, we'll get around to it. Yes. There is something that he's reading this like as a book report in class, and everybody is either there's a sort of heightened reality to this.
Yes.
You can't take it too seriously. And he's reading it and everybody seems like bored and they're like, whatever, this is just some loopy student or whatever. And then he gets to a part where he explains that when there's thunderstorms on their home world, everybody starts to fall into this state of lust that they call Thunderlust.
Thunderlust.
And are they all shape-changing?
Yeah.
Because he says that they'll start to... That he's like, men become women, women become animals, and the night throbs with their pleasure. And like everyone, the teacher's like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah. Well, I like the notion that this was a school project of, like, it's Heritage Day. So take a moment to tell somebody how your ancestors have embarrassed you.
Yeah.
So that was his, like, thunder...
Thunderlust.
Thunderlust.
They actually use a fair amount of the iconography. Their costumes are revamped from the show, and they look pretty cool. The artist who last drew the Power Rangers Justice League crossover, that's what you mentioned, Nick, Stephen Byrne.
Yeah, his art's great.
It's great. They actually look pretty cool. But there's a lot of iconography that tips the hat to the Justice League, the Super Friends TV show.
Yeah.
For instance, there is a Hall of Justice, which I believe in the comics they have been, in the last year or two, Snyder's story had a story where that did get erected.
Well, much all the writers, haven't all the writers grown up on this stuff at this point?
Yeah, so they're going to keep sneaking it in there.
Yeah.
But they are essentially like interning at the Hall of Justice. Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman are like their supervisors, for lack of a better word. They don't have like a ton of confidence in them, but it's not not a completely serious take on them.
It's a sitcom take.
It is a sitcom-y take. I feel like Justice League International from back in the day could be kind of considered the watchword on this.
But we find out a lot about Superman and Batman's first high school crushes, which was... Either you're going to find it funny or you're going to find it really annoying.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was right on the edge on both of them.
Because Zan was like, I was talking about like bombing out and being embarrassed with his Thunderlust story. And Superman and Batman both kind of like start saying, oh yeah, we had similar stories. Yeah, we each goofed up at some point when we were kids.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit out there.
But there is also a threat throughout
issue. Threat that's kind of a big threat that even though they're very behind the scenes, they end up interacting with. It is a fun series. Like, I actually feel like, especially, like, when I was in my teens and I was reading Justice League International, when I go back and I'm not a big fan of it now.
Well, that's pretty funny.
But it's, what's that?
It's pretty funny and you hate all humor.
It's not that funny.
It's not that funny.
It's a little
actually.
Sticky.
It is.
My favorite
I will
Justice
say this,
League.
This is slightly sticky too.
It is.
And I actually feel like this would be like an awesome comic, especially if I was in my teens. I like it now, but I think I would have really been about it then, and I think it's another good addition to their Wonder Comics line because it falls into a role that the others don't. Young Justice is very, it's kind of lighthearted adventure, but it's not lighthearted the way this is.
Well, I like that each one sort of occupies its own space. Like,
right, they
Young
all have
Justice
an identity.
Is action adventure, Naomi is mystery,
right,
and this one is sort of sitcom humor.
It's true.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wonder what Dial H's vibe is going to be.
I don't know.
Telecommunications propaganda.
There you go. I want Dial H to be good. I want somebody to come up with that concept and for it to actually stick.
It's always been good. Every version they've done has been good. It's just kind of a hard.
It is a hard
stick.
One.
Yeah.
They need something where it fits particularly in the DC universe and people like. They need to have people, the readers, to care.
Yeah.
But I think with something like this, which is. Comedy is kind of your through line. You need an artist that can handle that, where it can kind of do the mundane and make it fun.
Yep.
And Stephen Byrne is a really good pick for that.
Yeah,
he's great. The character designs are great. The rest of the Justice League and even like the Hall of Justice look very cool. And I think he's going to work well, I think, with the writer Mark Russell. So, I was not on board Young Justice particularly, but I know Nick, you are. Randy, did you? No, you're not. Like, you're not going to follow anything Bendis.
No.
But it was generally, I think, a success at the store too. Our coworkers and Kate liked it.
I think we all liked Naomi to different degrees, probably. But it was
not all of us.
Well, I'm not even including Randy in this.
You're not. You're an unperson for this conversation. Randy.
When it comes to Bendis, that is fair.
But anyway. I get generally considered this a third success in this series.
Yeah, I agree.
And I wouldn't expect everyone to hit every one of us, but a surprisingly strong track record for an initiative. Like, a lot of times when they're like, we're going to do a thing and we're going to create a whole bunch of new superheroes, or we're going to revamp all these superheroes, those kind of things usually flop. And here's one where there's, like, pretty successful. So
I consider this the first success for me.
Good job, Wonder Comics.
So Wonder Twins is a good first issue.
Nick, what you got?
I have a Marvel number one, and that is Avengers No Road Home number one.
By the way, Nick, you didn't say you and I had to. We had to negotiate.
We did have to negotiate
because you were going to pick Savage Sword and I was going to pick Avengers: No Road Home, and we decided we both couldn't have both of them.
It's true.
So we each took one.
Yes.
So both of us are co-signing our main picks.
Well, and I this comes with a caveat because the last Avengers: No Road Home, which is a weekly series, if I'm not mistaken,
and it was 16 parts.
It was 16 parts, and I didn't care for
Avengers:
it.
Avengers: No Surrender.
There's no surrender. It was no surrender. Yes.
And it's the same creative team, and you and I. Yeah, I think you and I fell off of it.
I thought it was okay at the start, but I just couldn't get into it. The writers on this are Al Ewing, Jim Zub, and Mark Waid.
All good writers.
All great writers. And, you know, you had me on page one where it's Hercules, one of my favorite characters, telling a boastful story about his past.
It's his main thing.
It is his main thing. And I feel like Waid was like, yeah, we should do this. Yeah. Or Al Ewing, who knows?
Who knows?
But it is kind of this fun opener where Hercules is trying to help out the, I guess, NYPD, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. As a, basically, a hardware store is being attacked by a monster that they think. There's more to it than that, but I'm not going to spoil it.
Yeah.
Honestly, this is a getting a band, a team together
issue. It's a bunch of little vignettes of like two characters together, and then they all wind up dragged into this Avengers story.
But here's the thing. In each of these little scenes, we learn so much about the characters and sort of where they are in their lives.
Yeah.
And I think the Scarlet Witch and Hawkeye, I like that she has a boyfriend now and wanting to move in together.
Yeah.
The Vision stuff is interesting because he's all sort of about, what is life? Am I dying? What does that mean for me?
Yeah.
We also learn more about where Monica Rambeau is in her life. By the
way, there's also Chekhov's Pym Particles.
Yes.
You don't introduce a vial of Pym Particles on the first page unless somebody's going to get big by the
end. Oh, yeah.
By the end of the
But there's also like references to like a bunch of his old Hawkeye's old arrows and a book that he had stashed away.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like all these people just made these scenes fantastic.
It hadn't clicked till right now that Al Ewing probably wrote the Hulk stuff because Al Ewing is writing Immortal Hulk.
Yeah.
And this feels like the same voice as that Hulk.
Okay, because I haven't been reading that, so I thought it was good. But I also thought it was really creepy just the voice of the Hulk. He's scary.
He clicks really well, and I was wondering how the Immortal Hulk, which is this weird sort of horror book, would fit in the larger context of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
And Al Ewing does a great job folding that sort of more horror-y Hulk into this Avengers book.
And all of this is sort of predicated on a large event that basically the sun is disappearing.
Yep.
And there's more to it. I'm not going to steal it.
No, I love the reveal. I love the villain.
The reveal is great. And it's all sort of this getting the team together by way of Voyager, which in No Surrender was revealed that she was supposed to be a founding Avenger that was lost.
Right.
But that was a trick, and she's actually was revealed to be the Grandmaster's daughter.
Which was kind of cool.
But she's like gone against the Grandmaster and kind of her own thing. Mm-hmm. I like that idea more, and that they're kind of delving into that is more interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think every page I was like, oh, that's fun. That's cool.
Me too. There's lots of fun moments. For one thing, I'm a sucker for a gathering the team together issue, and this was a good of gathering the Avengers. Also, the list of characters they're using here.
Yeah, it's the team.
It's really good. It's like, it's some weird, obscure characters who I would not see in the Avengers, and then it's the, it's like some Avengers, like, I always love seeing Hercules, I always love seeing Vision. I think Vision is a way, I'm sure Waid is the reason Vision's in there. Waid definitely has likes writing the Vision. I love seeing Monica Rambeau.
Who wrote the Hercules series from a little while ago?
That was Dan Abnett.
Oh, that's right. I was like, why? I wonder if like Al Ewing is a big Hercules fan or something, because he's not normally somebody that they.
But this team is a huge. It's a good mix of like big names and smaller names, and it happens to include several of my favorite characters.
Yep.
It's if for some reason you're not feeling the current Avengers book, like I am not, this is a good alternative. If you're liking the current Avengers book and want more Avengers, this is a good side project.
I agree.
It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I want to mention Paco Medina artwork, who I'm trying to remember the last time I saw Paco Medina do stuff.
He was on the New Avengers AIM book, whatever that was.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was.
Which one of those characters features in here, too.
Yep. So, I mean, it's fantastic.
Yep. Your backup?
My backup pick is Captain Marvel number 2. Which I loved the first one. It set up a new status quo for the character of Carol coming back to Earth and giving all sort of like all the side characters her relationship with Rhodey. I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And then the ending happened, and I thought she was going to get shunted off into this parallel world, and all of it was for naught. The second issue kind of reveals that that's not the the case.
I
was extremely happy about that.
Me too.
Because, yeah, she's in a kind of a parallel world, but a lot of other people are too. And it's not just like dark. It's like this weird kind of not an apocalyptic kind of place, but it looks very Mad Max-ish in some ways. But
you know, it's weird. The cover made me this made me remark earlier about one of Marvel's most bizarre alt futures, the Killraven future, where the Martians from the War of the Worlds have taken over. And for a minute, I was like, "Is there any chance that's actually that setting?" But it's not a specific Marvel setting.
No, right? It's actually like this weird bubble timeline that appeared on Roosevelt Island, and people who are inside it are kind of experiencing time in a different rate.
It's actually a little cool and goofy.
Yeah, it is.
For those who don't know. Kulan Goth was actually a Conan villain who showed up in X-Men through weird mystical means at one point, surrounded the island of Manhattan in a dome, and transformed everybody into like their fantasy, violent fantasy counterparts.
Yep.
It was a great two-part story. But yes, that is the sealed-off thing sort of reminded me of that.
I like what they're doing with Carol. I think she's interesting, and they're still building a relationship between like her best friends like Jessica Drew, and the new and characters like Hazmat, which most people didn't read the what was the Avengers Battle Royale.
Oh yeah, but anyway, it was a story with the Marvel's teen superheroes trapped on an island by Arcade. Clearly, an homage to Battle Royale.
It was Avengers Arena.
Avengers Arena. Yeah, Hazmat was a pretty major player in that, and it's nice to see her return.
Who's that artist, by the way?
This art is.
I should really like
somebody
it.
Somebody new, Cardina.
Carnero. Yeah, Carmen Carnero.
Okay.
Kind of Amanda Connor vibes in some ways.
It actually reminds me a lot of the artist who was doing Spider-Woman, who I'm blanking on, was one of my favorite artists. Wasn't
Robert Rodriguez? No, it's not Robert Rodriguez.
No, I want to say it was Javier or something. I don't remember. The artist who was doing Spider-Woman
was Javier Pulido, though.
It might be Javier Pulido I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Regardless, it's really good.
It's great.
They give a great sense of like the area, the backgrounds, and things
right,
like
right.
that.
It's super elaborate.
I also like that a random character, Echo, shows back up, which I hadn't seen for a while. But honestly, it's just sort of the execution and sort of the character interaction, the kind of weird situation that that they find themselves in. It's all just kind of interesting and makes me keep kind of wondering where they're going to go with this.
Yeah.
Also, this weird interpretation of the Radioactive Man.
He's not Radioactive Man. He's a different dude.
Is it? It's a different one?
His name is Machismo. He's the nuclear man now, but Machismo is his name.
That was a 70s character.
An old Gerber guy? Seems like a Gerber character.
I believe it was Lee and Kirby. I know because he showed up in an issue of She-Hulk, and this was during Burns' run, and he was from like a world where men kind of caveman-style dominate women.
Okay. So,
and
kind of lines up.
That's a good throw for Captain Marvel.
But when he comes to like try and claim She-Hulk in it, breaking the fourth wall as she did before Deadpool, she says something like, not Lee and Kirby's finest hour. Or something like that.
There are a couple things I like about this. One is that I really love the Spider-Woman book, and this feels like a spiritual successor to it.
Well, it's Kelly Thompson.
As far as what they're doing. Well, she wasn't writing that.
Oh, that's true.
But it just feels like it feels like the character feels right. I like seeing her. The other thing is, I'm always frustrated when a movie comes out and it's going to be a big hit and Marvel is not can't follow up on it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like Black Panther, while they didn't have, like, a good Black Panther book coming out when the movie hit, like, I don't think Ta-Nehisi Coates' book had started yet. And I feel like, and I also feel like Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, as good as it's been, is not a good fit for what people want out of a Black Panther movie.
Nope.
And I'm not sure this is going to be what people want out of the Captain Marvel movie. Like, it feels like it's not the 90s buddy comedy spy thing.
Right.
But it's a good book, and someone coming off of Captain Marvel, like, hey, is there a Captain Marvel book? I can hand this to them and be like, yes, if you like the movie, you're probably going to like this.
I agree. Dave, what's your backup?
The familiar series of Criminal from Ed Brubaker has its second issue this week.
The wacky comedy?
It is an offbeat issue in a way for it, although it's sort of something he's explored before, which is a weird intersection of crime and the comic book world.
Yeah.
But not in any sort of hokey way, because this is Brubaker, and shit's serious with Brubaker.
Yep.
So what you've got is a story set in, I'd kind of forgotten this, late 90s, where you have a guy who had been, the assistant inker?
Yeah, I think, he's basically a background assistant for a Golden Age great.
Silver Age great, or maybe even Bronze Age great,
yeah.
Who was, the guy is like a cantankerous alcoholic now, like think an older comics pro. Which, by the way, in the back, Brubaker said he's not based on anybody in particular. Don't freak it.
It was interesting that he actually said, he's like, look, I made all this up. It's not. Yeah. No one pulled a gun on Jerry Conway.
Yeah. And basically, this guy left him like, you know, he was like, so the dude said, hey, you're not going to amount to anything. Get out of here or whatever. And they're like left under bad circumstances.
Yeah.
But now this old pro, his like, agent or whatever, or assistant, calls him, this guy, and says, hey, you used to be his assistant. He wants you to come in and be, what, his assistant at a comic convention.
Yeah, basically his handler.
His handler, convention. Yeah. And, reminder, that was the word I was looking for. Yeah. And he doesn't know why, but the guy was really a legitimate idol to him. He's a great artist. Oh, when I see the art that was kind of meant to be his look,
yeah.
It's Alex Toth style.
Yeah.
Because they show him being associated with a late 60s cartoon, yeah. Which would be like Herculoids and those kind of things that Johnny Quest that Toth did the designs for. And this art style that they mimic for this character model sheet looks like him. Anyway, the guy, because he is his idol and he kind of maybe is a little glutton for punishment, he agrees to do it. They meet at the convention, and immediately this guy, there's that air of old white man asshole realism about him.
Yeah.
He tries to pick up a chicken cosplay and gets slapped, and the you know, the lead character comes up and he's like, what was that about? And he's like, oh, I offered her $100 to come back up to my room. And he's like, why? And he's like, I thought she was a prostitute. And he's like, aren't the booth babes all? And he's like, dude, she's not a booth babe. She's a fan. And it felt all too real.
Yeah.
It felt all too real. Mm-hmm. Even the way that I loved how what's his name? Who's the artist? Sean Phillips drew the guy where he had that kind of stooped over thing. You know, his head was a little hunched between his shoulders. He had real old man vibe to him.
Yep.
And it struck you as the kind of guy that's like, wow, this is the sort of person people tolerate because they're legends.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have some serious problems. But there is like a mystery. First of all, there's a mystery sort of going on. This guy in his past, when he himself, that legendary artist, when he was younger, was in a car crash with another famous cartoonist.
Right.
It looks to me like a guy who's sort of a Wally Wood type. And was the only survivor, and so there's some mystery and around that, and they do kind of make out. Is that what they said? He changed after the crash.
Yeah.
Because before, I think they said he was not like, you know, not the cantankerous a-hole he is.
It sounded like maybe it was sort of survivor's guilt, like he survived and his idol didn't, and then it changed him. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole bunch of twists and turns. We shouldn't give away the whole thing.
Right. Now I don't want to give away the whole thing. But, of course, there is a reason why he's brought in the guy. There's some entertainingly skeevy dealings, and there's things that feel very realistic about, like, the kind of scam that could happen at a comic convention. It was engrossing throughout. These are, like, double-sized issues, right?
I don't know. It feels like it. I don't think they are. I think he just packs the story in there.
I know he, like, the first issue was... But it's only $3.99, so yeah, maybe it just feels that way. Anyway, I feel like I'm getting my bang for my buck with every issue of these because it feels feels like two issues.
Also, I want to mention because I didn't read this issue, but I was flipping through it while Dave was talking.
The
back matter with sort of an article about Angels with Dirty Faces with beautiful illustrations by Sean Phillips of like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. Yeah.
They often profile like classic noir movies, crime movies. But all that kind
it's
of stuff.
Really, really good article and just good write up. And the artist, I mean, I talk about likenesses from artists. Sometimes they don't get it. Sean Phillips is damn good at his likenesses.
Yeah. What's interesting is that his main style isn't like about that.
No, it isn't.
But when he's doing illustrations for something, it's clearly within his talent pool.
Oh yeah, very much so.
Randy,
yeah.
What's your secondary pick?
All right, my secondary pick is actually Winter Soldier number 3.
Uh-huh.
I had been reading this and liking it. It's basically... the story of it was that there was this kid who was dressed like Bucky, and it was basically like a new Winter Soldier. He was clearly some kid who had been brainwashed by this guy named Mr. Colt. And in the course of the first couple issues, basically, this kid, sort of surrogate dad, shoots him, and Bucky, or Winter Soldier, wanted to take him under his care. So Winter Soldier's working for Sharon Carter as a freelance operative, trying to sort of get his redemption on. And now he's got this kid who reminds him of him, this kid who has been brainwashed and damaged and is very cynical and doesn't, you know, was supposed to kill Bucky. So they bring in Doc Samson to sort of psychoanalyze him, and he winds up going out on field missions with Winter Soldier, and they're doing this sort of almost like a Big Brother program kind of thing, but for brainwashed assassins. It's really good. I think they're deepening Winter Soldier's character in a way that really needed, where they give him a little bit of a more than just the redemptive arc, but also give him a little bit of character, like he's trying to build his life back up. Because he's a man out of time, just like Steve Rogers is, but in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
And they also use the Spot.
Yeah, I saw that.
Is being played up as like a dangerous assassin, which I think was a thing Wade did.
Yeah, Wade
he was
did,
used
definitely
creepily in, yeah. by Wade in Daredevil.
Yep.
And he does, by the way, he has one of those powers that that gives artists a lot of cool visual yep. options.
And the artist here is Rod Rice, who is doing sort of a Daniel Acuna thing here that I really dig. But I'm surprisingly invested in this book, and it's sort of nobody else is doing anything like it. So I like sort of seeing a little more Winter Soldier as a solo book, and would recommend people check it out. There's also, hilariously, it is written by Kyle Higgins,
mm-hmm.
who did Nightwing for a long time. And when they're trying to come up with names for RJ, he's like, you know, you could change your name. You could be Rick, and drop the K and make it look hip. And I'm like, is that a shot at DC?
It's almost got to be.
Yeah.
It's like, not approving of what's going on with the Nightwing book? I don't know. Anyway, it was it's pretty funny. I liked that bit. But I really like that. I would recommend it. Also on my stack this week, Marvel's Annotated, which picks up Marvel's number 0 and number 1. This is going to reprint the Marvel series that is the first painted book that
Just
Alex Ross
Just to real
Ross
quick
did.
Say it, because if you don't know what, like, Marvel's is like the name of it. It's not like Marvel apostrophe S.
I was getting to it.
Okay. I wasn't sure. It was just, it's a weird name now.
I guess. Marvel's was a miniseries that they did that was basically starts in the 1930s and goes up through the 60s and shows the Marvel Universe from the point of view of this sort of photographer on mm-hmm. the ground level. It was Alex Ross's earliest painted artwork, some of Kurt Busiek's oldest work, and it is a different point of view of the Marvel Universe.
There's a lot of stuff that Busiek did in this that we take for granted now.
Yeah.
That was like people weren't really doing at the time. So it's like the man on the street perspective on superheroes, which is actually very common now.
Yeah.
And so it loses a little luster there, but Busiek paints a pretty realistic view of like World War II era stuff, where. I love the thing where they're just hanging around, sitting on their cars, talking, and it's like the photographer is it Phil Sheldon?
Yeah, Phil Sheldon.
And he's like hanging out with a young J. Jonah Jameson and a couple other guys, and they're just smoking cigarettes and talking about, hey, what's with these costume guys who are starting to come around, and oh, you know, when do you think America's going to enter the war, and his vibe, his dialogue, you know, the. Even the slang that he picks up on for the time has a level of research and work put into it that kind of elevates it, even if you're used to the notion of superheroes from a pedestrian standpoint.
Yeah, this has been available in trade forever, but if someone wanted to try it out, this gives us... They've got the script, they've got some breakdowns, they've got a lot of annotations about sort of where the stuff comes plays. There's a Marvel Sources thing at the back.
Reprints the introductions by Busiek and Alex yeah. Ross, and also an introduction by Stan Lee, which is pretty yeah. great.
It's a nice little package of a book that I think we would all say is probably worth people's time.
Absolutely. You know, there's interesting, one of the annotations for one of the panels in there, there's a guy leaping on a building with, he's got like blue tights on and a red cape, and I was like, oh, is that Alex Ross being kind of cute and dropping Superman into this? He certainly snuck into the background some DC characters
yeah, yeah, yeah.
here and there, but it is not, in fact, it is one of those Golden Age Marvel heroes, the Golden Age version of Angel, introduced in Marvel Comics number 1, no less.
Right.
And certainly it is a visual cue off of Superman, but that is a... He actually just happened to have a blue tights and a red cape and kind of look a little like Superman.
That's a yep. question of you guys. Do you think this is Alex Ross' best work?
I think it kind of is for me.
For me it is. I know some people would put Kingdom Come or one of those, but this is for me his best stuff.
Weirdly, his period piece stuff, I love that sort of richness that it's got.
Yep. Yeah.
But it hasn't quite gotten to this sort of, he hasn't codified the look. I think he started to do that on Kingdom Come, and there were certain techniques he did in that that I actually didn't like as much.
His Human Torch in here...
the original Android one.
Android is just beautifully rendered.
It's difficult to draw a character that's on fire photorealistically.
Yes. Also on my list, the final issue of Ms. Marvel before Saladin Ahmed takes it over. Punisher number 8, which features Punisher organizing a Hydra prison riot, which is pretty great. Spider-Gwen Ghost Spider number 5, which has art by Takeshi Miyazawa, always notable. And then there are a bunch of graphic novels that I... Not get a chance to read, but was gonna quick shout out. There's something from Boom Kabooms. They're like a creator online called The Great Wiz and the Ruckus, which is a sort of like maybe a wizard journey. Looks like maybe a Oz kind of deal. Very nice artwork. There's a book called PTSD from First Second that has a spectacular design and also just gorgeous artwork.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's a veteran struggling for survival in a near future world, much like our own. There's a book called Bloom that is from First Second and has this sort of blue toned, really pretty artwork. And I believe this is sort of a slice of life story, maybe about a budding romance. But all three of these things, I'm not going to just look through them, but they're all like, oh, I want to read all these graphic novels. Spider-Geddon gets collected, which I think ultimately I was not as in love with as I was Spider-Verse, but there's some fun stuff in there. And I especially had some good stuff with Doc Ock and the Spider-Man from the video game.
I think anybody who's kind of riding high off of Spider-Verse stuff from the movie, in addition to, obviously, the Spider-Verse comic that inspired it, this would be an obvious follow-up.
There's one of these collections that Marvel's been doing of their digital stuff. This is Daughters of the Dragon, written by Jed McKay, who was not a name that was on my radar, but he did that Man Without Fear miniseries I really liked. And it's got art by Trevor Foreman and Joy Vasquez, who I believe have done some stuff on Marvel Knights. So I'm curious to check that out. DC's New Frontier by Darwin Cook gets a new printing under their Black Label, which includes everything as well as the special they did, as well as a bunch of extra stuff from Darwin Cook. It's basically, you get all the extras of the Absolute Edition without having to pay the $100 it costs to buy the Absolute Edition. And then there's a reprint of Ministry of Space, which is Warren Ellis and Chris Weston's alternate version of, like, England is the first one in space, and it's a sort of an alternate history sci-fi story. That's all I got. What else you guys got?
I've just got one or two I wanted to mention. Star Wars has been doing that Age of Republic series, all, you know, essentially set in the Clone Wars era. They do one with Count Dooku in here, which, you know, goofy name aside, Christopher Lee played him, and I like him. And I also, because, Nick, I don't know if you remember from when I was running the Star Wars RPG, y'all had an adventure on this planet, Sollust, the place where, what do you call it, who's Lando's co-pilot? Neenum.
Yeah.
It's where his folks come from. It's kind of an industrial, volcanic planet, but I ran an RPG, Star Wars RPG that had an adventure set there once. And so, Dooku is sent on a mission there. He's working his machinations for Palpatine. But he runs into an old a Jedi Knight that once looked up to him and is there on his own secret mission. And he's kind of like trying to figure out why this guy is here, whether their intentions intersect. There's definitely a bit of a, oh, does he actually have some fondness for this Jedi Knight to the point where he might, like, you know, if his scheme was going to overlap with him, that he would, like, he's going to show him some mercy, maybe even befriend him. I won't say what happens, but I will say Count Dooku is not a nice man, as it turns out.
I mean, his name is Darth Tyrannus. So, I mean, that's...
that's just a name. The name could be anything. Could be a tyrant of niceness.
Sure.
Nick, what else is on your list?
Hold on. I'm not done yet.
I was done.
There is this is the latest issue of Gideon Falls. It's on issue 11, so probably one more issue, and then they'll collect this next batch.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jeff Lemire's... Twin Peaks supernatural-ish kind of storyline. Just want to say this one is a particularly dreamlike issue with a lot of almost, I feel like, David Cronenbergian weirdness, insects bursting out of people's mouths and bodies, truly strange imagery, and some of the creepiest straight up dark, scary stuff in this. So I feel like in this issue, the series went from like kind of being suspenseful, supernatural, to like leaning into the horror side of things, which he does very well. And artist, was it Andrea Sorrentino? Is that?
Yeah.
I feel like did a good job with making the creepy stuff as creepy as Lemire clearly wanted it to be.
Would you say if you're like the way you're describing this reminds me of like a Stephen King kind of
story. It absolutely does, and the characters are those kind of like likable kind of. In some ways, everyman, but like, I mean, you know, there's a priest and a guy who's dealing with psychological issues and seeing a therapist about it who he's trying to bring in on this, but she's just kind of like can't take his paranoid theories at their word until she starts to see some weird stuff. They absolutely remind me of Stephen King characters and the sort of the tapestry that's kind of the story coming together. Nick, what you got? What else you got?
Just a few other things. Ironheart number 3 continues sort of Riri's reinvention of herself, her family life, dealing with new threats. I thought it was another really good issue. Runaways number 18, which kind of sees the second sort of... I don't know. This could have been an ending. I think
was the ending of the original series, was 18 issues.
Yeah. But they definitely are. Seems that Rainbow Rowell is going to continue on. But it's a great finale to the storyline. Went to a place I wasn't expecting. There's The Batman Who Laughs, number 3, which is dark and twisted and kind of bloody.
The things that people are looking for in a Batman Who Laughs story.
Exactly. Flash 64, which is the second part of the crossover with Batman. Joshua Williamson continues the story of Gotham Girl and what she's doing when she wants to be a hero. There's some great stuff dealing with sort of continuity in the DC Universe. Deals with Sanctuary and the stuff that's going on in Heroes in Crisis, but also with the relationship between Barry and Bruce, which I thought was fantastic, and how they view each other as sort of detectives.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it's the kind of thing I'd like to see more often in there.
Yeah, there's a lot of more humanistic qualities that Williamson brings to the forefront with their relationship, which is like talking about their sons, and Batman with Damian, and then Barry with Wally and a few others. And I don't know, it was just a really effective, very good issue. Speaking of father-son relationship, the last two that I have kind of deal with the same stuff. Thor number 10, which is all about Odin. It's told from his perspective, basically how he views himself as a father and how his relationship with his father, Bor, kind of works with his own viewpoint with his relationship between Thor. It's kind of a depressing issue, but it kind of fits with Norse mythology. And
in general, in mythology, fathers and sons have a tough time. About half the time, the son has to overthrow the father and, like, behead him or something.
Yeah, but for the longest time, Jason Aaron wrote Odin as an asshole. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. And, I mean, Odin is kind of an asshole, but I always liked the more kind of fatherly, like what Simonson wrote.
Yeah,
and
he was merely kind of tough love dad, and even at times, not even that. Sometimes he was just a concerned father.
Yeah, and Aaron brings a little more of that to the forefront. Mm-hmm. It's not a complete bastard. He's not a complete bastard.
Out of curiosity, was it an organic change? Like, did something happen to him
something
that
happened.
That changes
Jane
him a little
Foster,
bit?
Jane Foster definitely happened and sort of changed his heart a
little bit. So having not read that run, but although I've been thinking about it lately, did Jane Foster, I mean, like, did her Thor have a connection with Odin? I wasn't particularly, I didn't think of them as having worked together or
yes,
anything.
They actually had a rivalry.
Oh,
because he didn't know who had picked up the hammer,
right?
And basically thought of her as kind of a
usurper.
A usurper. In fact, I believe he calls her that.
Usurper,
times, which is always a cool thing to hear because you never hear that.
You know, somebody imperious is around when they shout that out.
And then this week sees the release of the complete collection of Mr. Miracle, the Tom King and Mitch Garrett's. In a one-volume thing, this is all 12 issues for the low price of $24.99. And honestly, it's a steal.
Right. We were realizing, well, how many issues is that?
12.
12 issues, yeah. That means that it's like they're about $2 each. That's super good.
Plus, you get all the variant covers. You actually get thumbnails from Mitch Gerrards on like all of his potential different covers, which I thought was really interesting. Just seeing sort of his layout choices. This is a fantastic series that had an ending that made me kind of question whether I liked the series until I really kind of thought about it, and that it sort of makes work. But I honestly think more people should check it out. Word. That is it. That is all that I have.
All right. That is all for us this week. We started a little late. We had a lot of stuff to talk about, so we got some topics we'll come back to next week. But until that time,
yo, Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.